From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Joy Powers. Today we'll speak with the new CEO of Milwaukee Film about changes the organization has been making. In Capital Notes, we'll look at how the Harris campaign is courting Wisconsin and how it compares to Hillary Clinton's run in 2016.
Night and day. There are visits here, there are ads here. I mean, Clinton wasn't really running ads in Wisconsin. It was really not a strongly run campaign.
Plus, we'll visit a Pay What You Can cafe in Milwaukee to learn about the solutions they've found to hunger and food waste.
You could do this on every street corner in the city, and there wouldn't be a sense of competition because the need is that great. There are more people today that are hungry than in my lifetime I have seen.
All of that is coming up on Lake Effect. But first, here are today's headlines. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Joy Powers, and thank you so much for joining us. We'll start today with a conversation about Milwaukee Film. The nonprofit recently cut its education and artist services programs. This came not long after Milwaukee Film took over operation at the shuttered Downer Theater. Earlier this spring, Ann Reed was named the CEO of Milwaukee Film. She tells Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez that the program is focusing on operating its theaters.
When you took the job, you know, because Milwaukee Film and Milwaukee Film Fest has also grown quite a bit over the past couple decades, how familiar were you with the organization and kind of the work that was done?
With the organization itself, I wasn't. I have to say, I was one of many people who had not yet discovered what a treasure this is. I led the Wisconsin Humane Society for 12 years from 2010 to the end of 22. So the basics of how nonprofits work, that was all very familiar. But learning this arts environment and film in particular has really been a joy.
Since you've been here, there have been some changes. Mm-hmm. One of them is the opening of the historic Downer Theater, the reopening of the historic Downer Theater, 109 years old. How's that been?
What a privilege to know that that theater is open and we're the reason why, and that the people who support us are the reason why. The Downer is Wisconsin's oldest theater, oldest operating theater. It closed last September, just about a year ago, and the idea of that place going dark with its historic significance as a theater, with the significance of the neighborhood that it anchors, the idea of it staying closed, if we could possibly open it, was, it just didn't seem like something that we could envision. So it is open now, and it very much depends on continuing support, people going there, and people becoming members of Milwaukee Film in order to keep it going. We're so proud that we could do it, but we do continue to need help to keep that theater open.
Something else that's really exciting and very new this year is the Dialogues Documentary Festival, which WWM is a sponsor. Please tell me more about this fest and what you're expecting.
Thank you for sponsoring it. We're so excited about this. One of the things I hear a lot is people telling me that the fall is a great time for they want to watch films, and especially they want to watch documentaries, because we all love back to school. And even when we're too old to be literally going back to school, we all love this idea that this is a time to learn and grow and expand our minds. And that's what documentaries powerfully do. So we have gathered documentary films into a single four-day festival. We show documentaries from time to time through the whole year and in the Milwaukee Film Festival in the spring. But this is just documentaries from Thursday through Sunday, September 26th through the 29th, at both theaters, here at the Oriental and over at the Downer. There'll be 35 films in all across that weekend, all documentaries. And then the reason we're calling it Dialogues is wherever we can, we're pulling people together, both the filmmakers and also people in town who are working around the issue that that documentary features, in order to have a conversation afterwards. So really convening important conversations as well as learning. We are super excited.
I love the idea of being able to process together what a film or how it landed, especially talking about doc film. It's also been a tough year as well because there have been some cuts that have had to happen, thinking about the Young Filmmakers Lab and Culture and Community last year, but then also the educational program. As you're kind of moving forward, what is the vision for Milwaukee Film?
We produce Milwaukee's best arts and entertainment event in the Milwaukee Film Festival. We are keeping two amazing historic theaters open with incredible programming through the year. We must commit making sure that our community can continue to have those things that only we can do. If we go away, they go away, and they can't go away. It's so important. So what we did, and you see a lot of other organizations doing the same thing, El Verno College just did a similar analysis. What is it that only we can do? And what is it that we're doing really well and we're really proud of and we love it, but in fact, others are doing similar things really admirably? And you take something like educational children's programming that we're doing, and you look around town, and many organizations are using the arts to educate children in a wonderful way. So for us to say, once we focus on what can only we do, it was difficult, but in the end, really clarifying and motivating to say, we're going to give this community this as hard as we can and do it. Now, I will say, on cultures and communities, it is true that the specific programs and department with that name, we're not continuing. But people can really think of the Dialogues Documentary Festival as an extension of that type of work. It is bringing people together to have conversations about key issues. Cultures and Communities was very focused on both community topics and topics around belonging and inclusion. And if you look at the lineup of dialogues, you will see a continued commitment to conversations around those issues.
Speaking of cultures and communities, that was, I think, a deep blow for a lot of filmgoers of color and just arts supporters of color in the city. Thinking of like the people who backed it up, who designed it, who had the outreach of things. Are people being brought in a similar way, people that are credible in the arts community, into dialogues and documentaries?
Sure. As you look, for example, in the program for dialogues, you'll see a black table about kids in the class of 1994 at Yale creating a space for themselves. You'll see Missing from the Fire Trail Road about the amazing fact that many, many Indigenous women are missing. You will see a film called Admissions Granted, which is about the complicated interplay of affirmative action in colleges as applied to or not applied to Asian Pacific Island folks. The kinds of people that you'll see who can have those panel conversations about those, you will see that, yes, we are continuing to bring committed people who are deeply involved in these issues. The fact is, once you say film is what we do differently than the way anybody else is bringing arts to this town, and now you say, let's get to issues around cultures and communities through that, it is a deep, deep lens into those conversations.
I think that the dialogue is really important. I love a talkback. Mm-hmm. I think some of the things that I've noticed in some of my talkbacks, especially when I go to programs like the Cine Sin Fronteras mm-hmm. programming or even the Black Lens programming, is that a lot of the audience doesn't represent those communities that are portrayed on the film, meaning that there are a lot of white folks that are coming in and engaging, and then also really engage heavily in the talkbacks, where it almost feels like it's a conversation not for the community that you're showing the film for. Mm-hmm. And I know there was reporting, as far as there hasn't been tracking of like the audience, the demographics of how diverse the community is that are attending the screenings and filmings here, which is a stated mission of Milwaukee Film, is like really to dig in and represent diverse communities. The question that I just have is, as you pivot to film mm-hmm. and you're kind of like losing some of that programming arm, what is the plan to kind of wrap your arm around those folks that either weren't coming in the first place or now feel like the org may have shifted underneath their feet?
First of all, Black Lens Programs continues. We have a posted job posting right now to fill that role. Cine Sin Fronteras continues. Genre Queer continues. We are deeply proud of those programs. And when you go to the festival, you'll see that. You saw them at this past spring's festival. You see them through the festival. Every organization should be trying to get better. And people say, what about this group or that group? And I'm very interested in those conversations of where should we go from there. In terms of audiences, there are two parts to the answer. One is, every arts organization in town wants to be more diverse in its audiences. I frankly think our audience, compared to those of other arts organizations in Milwaukee or frankly almost anywhere, is probably the most diverse, certainly in terms of age, background, I mean, I love it when I look at the audience and I see a young couple still wearing their wool hats next to an older couple. Their lives when they go back home are not going to be the same, but they're laughing with each other. But every arts organization does and should want to be reaching the widest audience that they can. And metrics are a part of that. Measurement is part of that. Like many arts organizations, we are coming to those measurements in ways that for-profit companies were ahead of us on. It's hard to, when you have somebody buy a ticket, ask them how they identify their ethnicity. But these are things that all arts organizations need to start moving to. Because only when you have those numbers can you start to see where exactly your gaps are and closing them. At the same time, though, I will say I've had several people whose work is to try to make an impact for racial justice, let's say, in Milwaukee, and large, more broadly for quality of life in all of Milwaukee's communities, people whose full-time job that is, who have said to me, yes, we want the most diverse audiences we can across Milwaukee's arts community, but also we want people to see films that have these messages because they are the ones who need to hear those messages. That is to say, there are two parts to bringing a true sense of community impact in the sense that we're talking about to Milwaukee. One is bringing the full community into your audience, but the other is getting that community's messages out to other audiences. And I think that's sometimes an overlooked piece.
When I say I truly enjoy the work that I was able to do, I really did. At one point, I was working a full-time job, going to graduate school full-time, and then working at Milwaukee Film part-time.
This is Tiana Clayton Mallett, and she was a Black Lens programmer.
Being able to be part of a program and to create an experience for people, it got to a point where people are like, all right, we're getting ready. What's happening with Black Lens? What's happening with Milwaukee Film? We're getting ready for the festival. People would get ready. So there was just excitement. I even created or started thinking about ways that we can involve youth more in cultures and communities, and was able to pilot a program called Souls of Young Folk. During the pandemic, I think cultures and communities really saved Milwaukee Film. We were really providing a lot of great programming virtually, and it was sad to see Milwaukee Film get on the diversity train with all of what was happening with the racial unrest due to the death of George Floyd, you know, just make these statements and then say that, you know, because of financial crisis and whatnot, all the diversity stuff is the first to go. That is kind of textbook of a lot of organizations now are just like, oh, we're done. You know, let's wipe our hands clean. That was fine. It was sad. And what was even worse, in my opinion, was the way that it was done. I don't think it was people-centered. It left a lot of people wondering if their job was secure. You had a lot of employees that were scared for themselves. It was just like, you don't treat people like this. Like, Milwaukee Film is not a big corporation. It is a small organization. Again, Milwaukee is predominantly Black and Brown city. How are you going to be accountable to the communities? You want to show just film. Okay, Black Lens celebrated 10 years this year. No acknowledgement? None of the work that was done? That's just shady and wrong. That's just shady and wrong. And so that was... I just left a bad taste in my mouth. It really did. You know, sometimes I'll say to people, who am I? I don't have a whole bunch of money within Milwaukee and all these other accolades and whatnot, but I do know that things could have been different. I do know that things could have been handled differently where people are treated with dignity and respect, and how everything went down, that was not it. So to the Black and Brown community, there are a whole bunch of spaces where you are celebrated, and I would support those spaces, make those your priority. Don't be afraid to hold Milwaukee Film accountable. I know Milwaukee Film will not stop showing, you know, a variety of films. There, you know, the Black Lens program will still go on. They will still, you know, screen those films and whatnot. So, you know, support as your spirit leads you. Support as you see fit. You know, to Milwaukee Film, I still appreciate my time there. I learned a lot. I got to experience a lot. Every time I talked about Milwaukee Film, I would always say Milwaukee has one of the top film festivals in the country. There was a lot of pride in the work that I was able to do, and I'm glad that I was supported. And I'm just really sad that, like, Milwaukee Film just is like any, like many other organizations that seems like they're putting this this diversity work to the side. You had so much experience and so much relationships. I don't think Milwaukee Film understands how important relationships are within, let me speak personally from what I've seen within the Black community within Milwaukee. Relationship building is extremely important. And we were just there, just getting there, and then it's wiped from under us. But I hope that especially the new ED can hear, you know, a variety of narratives of what took place. And I hope the board can have some level of accountability. Like, what does that look like? You got rid of Cultures and Communities. Now what? What's the plan? What is the plan?
That was Tiana Clayton Mallett. She previously worked at Milwaukee Film as the Black Lens Coordinator for Community Outreach. Ann Reed is the CEO of Milwaukee Film. Both spoke with Lake Effect's Jimmy Gutierrez.
This is Capital Notes from Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Mayan Silver, less than 2 months until the 2024 election, and J.R. Ross is here as our trusty guide. He's editor of WizPolitics.com. Welcome, J.R. Thanks for being here.
Hey, thanks for having me.
All right, so J.R., former independent presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr., who withdrew from the race last month, has filed a lawsuit in Dane County Circuit Court. He's asking to force his way off of Wisconsin's presidential ballot. It's one of three suits he's filed in three separate states. Before we get into the procedure of this, can you tell me why it may make a difference politically whether Kennedy is on or off the ballot in Wisconsin?
Well, former President Trump wants him off the ballot. He's afraid of him taking votes away. If you go look at the last Marquette Law School poll, we got a new one in a couple of days, but last one had Kennedy 8%. Among his supporters, 10% were self-identified Republicans. I think it was like 4% were Democrats. So he was pulling more people from Trump than from Harris. And the idea or the fear among Republicans is that Kennedy could, in a state like Wisconsin, sway things a little bit. So they like to see him off the ballot to try and improve Trump's chances in Wisconsin and other states.
All right. So with that backdrop, Kennedy is arguing that a state law that prevents him from withdrawing means he's treated differently from Democratic and Republican nominees. Can you explain what's the difference between ballot access candidates like Democrats and Republicans, Trump and Harris, and independent candidates like Kennedy?
Sure. For a Democrat or Republican, they hit certain benchmarks every election. They've got ballot access. So their process is they have a deadline of the first Tuesday, September, to certify Elections Commission who their nominee is going to be. So that's why, for example, Joe Biden was never actually on the November ballot in Wisconsin because he was never certified by the Democrats. They did that at their national convention, certified Harris. She's put forward for the election commission to consider. Pretty straightforward process. Now, there are other requirements that they have in state law that you have to follow if you are a ballot access candidate like that. But that's the process. For an independent, which is what Kennedy sought to get the ballot on, you have to collect signatures, at least 2,000 statewide, a maximum of 4,000, and turn them in by August 6th. Under state law, there's no mechanism for a candidate for office to withdraw nomination papers once they've been submitted. The Kennedy lawsuit argues that there's an unfairness to that, and that basically you have a deadline to decide if you're going to run of August 6th if you're an independent. But if you are a Democrat or Republican, you have until early September. That's not fair. Now, there are different processes. And don't forget, once you turn in signatures, the commission must take time to examine them. You could, you know, they want to make sure nobody just like fills in a bunch of fake names, right, 2,000 times. So they go through each signature, make sure it's valid, or, you know, run some checks on it and that kind of thing. The suit argues the process takes too long, that even if they need time to review those nomination papers, they don't need a full month essentially to do it. And there should be a different process. It's not fair essentially to have Kennedy on, but Joe Biden not.
All right. And this suit comes as county clerks have already begun sending ballots to their printers ahead of a deadline in 2 weeks to deliver them to local election officials. What do you see as the end game in this lawsuit? The Wisconsin Supreme Court, is that where it's going to head? And is there a practical possibility that he could get off the ballot?
Well, in talking to lawyers this past week, I mean, Kennedy might have a point, but he's got a timing issue. So if you go back 4 years ago, the Green Party filed a lawsuit because it was not allowed to be on the presidential ballot. They went to the court, Supreme Court of Wisconsin, said, hey, we want to be you to force our way on the ballot so that we qualified. There were some issues with the nomination papers that they had gathered the signatures on. The Supreme Court ruled in mid-September, hey, you're too late. You waited until September 3rd to file your lawsuit. Ballots were basically already being printed. We can't stop the process now because that's too late. Well, fast forward to now, Kennedy's lawsuit was filed 4 years to the day after that Green Party lawsuit. Clerks have already been to the printer to drop off their ballots. I talked to several last week who were either at the printer or about to go to the printer. They face a tight deadline. September 18th, they must have ballots in the hands of local clerks. Those municipal clerks on the 19th have been mailing them out to those who have an absentee ballot request already on file. So it takes a week or two sometimes to print ballots. These clerks can't wait. There's a challenge there for Kennedy to convince a Dane County judge, say, hey, even the process has started, even though state law clearly says you can't take back nomination papers, you should take me off the ballot. So he may have a point. I mean, it's an interesting legal argument, right, about whether there's different treatment of major party candidates versus third party ones and independents. But the timing is the problem. It's a tight window for these clerks to get this stuff done. And if you delay it, you start impacting when voters get ballots. That can be a problem.
And do you see this ending up in the Wisconsin Supreme Court? And would it be the Wisconsin Election Commission that would be, you know, appealing the ruling if the ruling was for Kennedy in the trial court?
Well, at this point, I mean, we haven't even seen a hearing scheduled in Dane County Court. So there's a possibility this thing might just kind of like wither on the vine, as some attorneys have told me, because there's just, you know, usually you get some time to respond to a lawsuit. There's a window for this. It's unique to file it this late and try and get something changed. So I'm not quite sure what's going to happen legally, but realistically, there's not a great chance it's going to go very far.
Gotcha. All right. You're tuned into Capital Notes. I'm WAWM's Mayan Silver, speaking with J.R. Ross, editor of WizPolitics.com. All right. Surrogates, surrogates, surrogates. President Joe Biden was in southwestern Wisconsin on Thursday. He announced $7.3 billion in federal investments in clean energy for rural America. Donald Trump's campaign had surrogates in Milwaukee that night. What's the latest messaging in general from the presidential campaigns in the dairy state?
Oh, you know, Republicans will talk about the economy, inflation, things that they think they're doing well on. Democrats want to talk about, like, the president, investments in rural Wisconsin, abortion, democracy. I mean, basically they're hitting their highlights, their main points they want to make, and there's a good reason why. There's a messaging thing here is also like a math thing. So look at Joe Biden going to western Wisconsin, Westby. It's a small town south of La Crosse. Look, it's part of the 3rd Congressional District. Harris is probably not going to win that. Trump won it in 2020, won it in 2016. It's not about winning the district. It's about narrowing the gap. Because if you think about Wisconsin as a puzzle, there's a big blue piece in Dane County. It is a turnout machine for Democrats. There's this red piece that goes around Milwaukee, the wow counties, Waukesha, Ozaukee, Washington, that have gotten a little less deep red over the years. Go up to Wausau, where, you know, Trump was at Saturday, the Mosinee area for his rally. That's gotten red over the years. What I'm getting at is, if you're a Democrat, you want to try and narrow that gap in Western Wisconsin, rely on that deep blue Dane County, rely on Milwaukee turning out strongly, rely on the Wow counties getting a little more purple. That's your path to success to win statewide. If you're Trump, you want to run up the score in the 3rd Congressional District. You want to run up the score in the 7th CD, which is where he was at with, you know, the Mosinee visit. Then you want to reverse that trend in Waukesha and try and get back into the, you know, the mid-60s, the low-60s. That's your path to success. And also, if you're Trump, you want to minimize your loss in Dane County. Trump's not going to win Dane County, but he's got to get 20, 21, 22% at least, give himself a shot. If he's at 18% in Dane County, he's in real trouble. And the challenges for Trump is, a place like Mosinee, there's only so many voters, and only so many you can turn out more than you had 4 years ago. So how do you get enough people in these rural areas to offset the problems in the more populated areas like those Wild counties? You've got to stem the tide in the Wild counties and reverse that trend a bit to improve your chances of winning Wisconsin.
And of course, Republicans are trying to do the same thing in the deep blue areas like Milwaukee and Madison. They're trying to narrow the gap as much as they can. But speaking of Biden, it was his 6th trip to Wisconsin in 2024, but his first since he announced on July 21st that he was dropping his reelection bid. We've been talking a lot about, you know, the enthusiasm jump that Democrats experienced ever since Harris jumped to the top of the ticket. Is that holding steady?
Well, you know, we'll see a new Marquette poll in the coming days. It may be another look at enthusiasm, but the gap definitely closed with the base, at least. Now, there are probably some Biden supporters who aren't big Harris fans. We'll see. But the reality is that Joe Biden had really kind of fallen off quite a bit in terms of exciting people. I mean, no offense to the president, the crowd he had at Westby was a, you know, invite-only kind of event, but he didn't turn out people like Kamala Harris did in Eau Claire a few weeks back, or in Milwaukee during the national convention. She filled an arena in Milwaukee on the same night that she had a national convention going on 90 miles south. Like, Biden wasn't drawing those kind of crowds. At the same time, you know, Biden's an effective messenger with certain people. He's also being effectively deployed, going to Westby, trying to drive a message to rural Wisconsin of, hey, you're not forgotten. Republicans have been really pounding on that with the last few years, that Democrats have abandoned rural Wisconsin, rural parts of the country, in their words. And we have seen the Democratic brand collapse in rural Wisconsin. I've been covering politics here for almost 25 years. I remember Democrats representing rural Wisconsin, and not just a few of them. They're a good, decent number. There aren't that many anymore. You know, they're more concentrated in urban areas and suburban areas. That's changed. They need to bring the brand back to improve their chances of winning Wisconsin. I mean, we are such a razor's edge. Remember, the last 6 elections for president in Wisconsin, 4 of them decided by 23,000 votes or less. That is always on the razor's edge. Every vote you can find in any county is going to help you try to, you know, stem the tide or get things going your direction in a state like Wisconsin.
Remember in 2016 when Hillary Clinton lost the state and people were kind of blaming her for not showing up and not doing what she needed to do, and there was no pandemic or anything like that happening at the time. Do you see any of those same notes in Wisconsin now for Democrats, or is it completely a totally different picture with all these visits?
Night and day. There are visits here, there are ads here. I mean, Clinton wasn't really running ads in Wisconsin. It was really not a strongly run campaign, and she was trying to expand the map. The polling was bad in 2016. Democrats always believed that the map had expanded, that Clinton had a path to run up a huge score on Trump because he looked very unpopular, and it didn't turn out that way. It turned out a lot of quiet Trump supporters who weren't answering calls for pollsters, and they turned on election day and won. And Democrats weren't very enthusiastic about Hillary Clinton. Well, neither were independents. You know, she didn't get that enthusiasm. It's not the same with Harris. Now, that might not be enough. There's a lot of enthusiasm for Democrats in 2020 because they were, one, like Biden, but two, didn't care for Trump. So it was a 21,000 vote race plus change. So we are going to be close, more likely in Wisconsin, barring something crazy happening in the next 2 months. So again, every vote matters, every precinct matters, every county matters, to try and get people to kind of excited and turn out in November.
And state GOP chair Brian Schimming knocked the president's return to Wisconsin. He called it the comeback tour that no one wanted. He complained about runaway inflation and mayhem at the southern border was his message. Are you seeing Wisconsin Republicans and the Trump campaign sort of regain their footing and find ways to attack Harris instead of Biden now?
Oh, they want to tie Harris to Biden. You know, I mean, she was part of the administration. They want to make the point over and over again that all the decisions that were made by Biden, she was part of. They've talked about the withdrawal from Afghanistan, which obviously did not go very well at all, that she was the last person in the room, quote unquote, for that decision was made, how the pullout was handled. They want people to remember that she is part of the Biden administration. Harris, meanwhile, wants to talk about change, that she's a new candidate trying to separate herself somewhat from Biden. She wants, doesn't want to necessarily abandon him or, you know, whatnot, but she wants to make it seem like she is this new candidate who is a fresh face, somebody who's, you know, new and different, not Biden. It's a tightrope for her to walk, but that's definitely something she's trying to do in this election.
All right. Thanks for the insights, JR, and thanks for joining me on Capitol Notes.
Anytime.
J.R. Ross is the editor of WIS Politics. He speaks with WUWM's Mayan Silver for Capitol Notes every other Monday. You can also listen to Capitol Notes as a podcast wherever you like to listen. In about 15 minutes, we'll explore one of Wisconsin's most popular hikes. But first, we'll visit Milwaukee's Trickle Bee Cafe, where they're working to fight food waste and prevent hunger in the community.
We take the discards and make them into fruitful things. So this discarded soil became this beautiful garden, and discarded food becomes beautiful soup. But we find that discarded people become family to us.
That's coming up next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. WUWM and the NPR Network are dedicating this week to stories about climate solutions. The focus is on food. Climate change is affecting our food, and food is affecting our climate. This week, we search for solutions. We'll start Climate Solutions Week with a story about a pay-what-you-can cafe in Milwaukee's Sherman Park neighborhood called Trickle Bee Cafe. It was started by Christy Melby Gibbons, who moved from California to Milwaukee in 2015. The ordained minister wanted to find a way to serve the community, and food is what she found. WUWM environmental reporter Susan Benz joins her at the cafe to learn about their operation.
This orchard it's actually like a city lot that they sort of let neighbors do things on. Mm-hmm. So for over the years, sometimes trees die and we'll plant other things like apples, pears, plums, there's raspberries. Cool. And we harvest them. The apples are ready and we've been picking them. Neighbors pick them. We make apple crisp, apple juice, apple muffins, apple everything. In the throwing away realm, we are at a point where we only put one tall kitchen trash bag of trash out a week. And we're serving like 100 people a day. And that's the only trash we're generating, the true waste. It's just one bag. The rest is composted, recycled, or we just don't buy things or receive things with a lot of packaging. So we get a lot of fresh produce, so there isn't plastic and cardboard. So that helps a lot. So we're trying not to add to the waste stream, and we're even interrupting the waste stream by getting leftovers from the West Allis Farmers Market and things that, and at the end of food give outs that are left over, they bring them to us. Nobody wanted them. It's usually kale, kohlrabi, all the stuff that we love. So we're sort of scavengers for the things that would be wasted.
You know, talk about the food that's coming in. Some you are now growing, or is your garden that's evolved nearby really a resource for neighbors to come and harvest themselves?
It's a little bit of both. Neighbors will pop over and grab herbs or some tomatoes if they want them. Right outside of the cafe is two huge herb gardens. We grow sage, thyme, dill, rosemary, all of the ones that we love to use. We like fresh herbs, but sometimes we dry them. We bought this 16-tray dehydrator, so we put a lot in there. And then across the street, there's a community garden. We have two beds there, and that's more produce for the cafe because we pay to have those beds. But it's always fresh, it's organic, it's local. We can't ask for better than that.
Do you think this is a model that could be replicated, for example, within Milwaukee? I mean, how do you think this could be expanded? It's creating community through food, but obviously the food is critical for people's well-being.
Right.
I mean, all the way around.
Yeah, I think our core focus is on building community, and then we're like, oh, and we make good food too, you know? People come through the door. And then the food is sort of a byproduct of just being together. We make good food and serve it. But I think it's 100% replicable. You could do this on every street corner in the city, and there wouldn't be a sense of competition because the need is that great. There are more people today that are hungry than in my lifetime I have seen. We see more people coming through that don't know where their next meal will come from. And that is the definition of a food desert. You don't know where this next meal is coming, so you scrounge for whatever you can, and it's usually junk from these corner stores. So we are offering a very different model where everything's fresh, you have choice in what you order, and you pay what you can. If you have nothing at all, you can volunteer your time. And that, I would be willing to train anybody up on how to do it.
Day to day, are you in the kitchen cooking with your chefs, or what, are you just everywhere?
Right. Now that we're 8 years in as the executive director, I am less in the kitchen, which is kind of a good thing because I can do more admin things, get the word out by going and talking about what we do in different areas. But I am often in the kitchen helping, prepping food for the day, chopping vegetables, washing vegetables from the garden. We have a staff of 5 people. And everyone else is a volunteer who comes through. We probably have 20, 25 volunteers a week.
That's growth.
Yes, it is.
I mean, in terms of who you're able to employ.
Yep, we're definitely growing.
So what are those 5 people doing?
So we have our cook. We have a kitchen assistant who is like the dish person, but also helps wherever it's needed. So making drinks, bussing tables, kind of the jump-in person. We have a cafe manager. I think I said that already. She oversees everything and does sort of what I do if I'm not around or not available. And then a custodian, and then myself as full-time executive director. So right around the corner from the cafe, attached to our wall, is a lot that was a building back in the 90s, apparently. And it was so run down that the city just kind of grazed it, flattened it, and it just sat here. It was an empty lot that was mowed every week. But nothing was on it. We started sort of using it over the years for little pop-up events. Kids would play out here if we had children's events. And then we started doing a little more. We put up a little stage that was movable. We put up a movable garden bed. We put up a planter by the bus stop. And after a while, I was like, this is silly. It's kind of ours. We should just ask if we could buy it for $1. I offered the city $1. They laughed at me. And they said, how about $500? I'm like, okay, we'll do it. So gave them $500 and all we have to do is remove the snow when it snows on the sidewalk around the lot.
So this is a shelter for when we actually have cold weather or rain,
yes.
I suppose?
Yeah. We're not supposed to build bus shelters, apparently, so we built a planter near the bus stop, and it happens to have a little roof and a standing area when it's raining.
And who did the artwork?
This is all our kitchen assistant, Julio Nieves, had his 5-year anniversary with us, mm-hmm. And we learned during the COVID shutdown that he's like an excellent artist. It just sort of came up and we're like, wow. So when we were all working from home, we were designing a cookbook and a comic book. He was illustrating everything. And I said, why don't we do a mural on that west facing wall? And he came up with the idea. It's a vegan pirate who goes on adventures around the world to find exotic foods to share with others.
Cheerful hearts, continual feast, cozy chapel.
Yeah, that's our little motto. The 3 things that we're about every day. And people sometimes come in and say, where's the chapel? I'm like, well, you're sort of in it. This place is a chapel in the sense that you can just be at peace here and seek oneness with others and with the divine. Yeah.
So Christy, when you came to Milwaukee, did you already have this vision the cooking part was something you already did personally or what?
I had inklings that we were going to do something food related. I didn't quite know what, and I definitely didn't know where in the city. We bought a house and I knew within the 1-mile stretch of our home that something would feel right. So I spent like 8 months just walking up and down North Avenue, looking in all these abandoned storefronts, and I thought one of these is going to feel just right. And this one was pretty dumpy, kind of smelled funny. But I knew the minute I stepped inside that it was just right. It felt like the building said, this is the one. And I still feel that every time I walk in, like, this is the one. You're in the right spot. And now we own the building. We were renting for 5 years and had a chance to buy it and fixed it up with grant money, and it's been great. And we're going to pass by the two big herb gardens that we have. They're sort of untended at the moment. We're just letting the bees have a heyday out here with all the flowering herbs. And they really do. We love helping the pollinators out this time of year. So.
Oh, and here as well. And so you harvest patch, some of this or not?
We do. This patch was sort of an accident. We have some volunteer gardeners who took some dirt from that was going to be thrown out from a microgreens farmer in the area. It was just old dirt from those trays. And literally all of the seeds that were stuck in the dirt popped up. So there's mustard greens and kale and broccolini growing everywhere in this little parkway strip. So we harvest it all the time, but it doesn't look very orderly.
It sort of symbolizes what's going on here at Trickleby.
I think all the time of, like, we take the discards and make them into fruitful things. So this discarded soil became this beautiful garden, and discarded food becomes beautiful soup. But we find that discarded people become family to us. There are so many people in our neighborhood who, for whatever reason, have been pushed aside, forgotten, or intentionally excluded because maybe they're unhoused, maybe they have an addiction problem, maybe it's the color of their skin or how much money they have or something, but we are a place where they can come and feel like they're part of this thing, part of a family. They can work with dignity here. There's no expectation that they have to leave who they are at the door. They can come in as they are, be who they are, and be welcomed as they are, and their gifts are valued.
Talk a bit about the food. You're getting contributions.
Yes, so the Jewish Community Center has a large food give out weekly, and whatever they have excess of, it's not always, but sometimes they'll have a few boxes of something and they'll bring it over to us because they don't want to see it wasted, and we can use it even if it's ugly produce. Then the West Dallas Farmers Market, every other week, they have a setup with nonprofits that whatever's left, they don't want to schlep it back to the farm, so they say you can come fill up your car and take whatever you need back to your nonprofit as long as it's being used to feed people.
And that's the case for other nonprofits.
Yes,
you're not the
we're
only,
one of many who pick up there. Mm-hmm. Trader Joe's has sometimes reached out to us with excess produce, and they say if you can pick it up, you can have whatever you can fit in your car, so we get organic food there. It just finds us. Yeah. People find this food and call us, and we're like, sure, bring it over. If we can't use it directly, we can give it out to families.
So you're really finding that system is working, that you can get it to people in there.
Yeah, and we really don't buy fresh produce anymore. It just finds us, or we grow it. In the winter, the deep of winter, we might have to start buying onions and celery because we run out of things, but we really don't have to buy it.
Give me an example of people who keep this place evolving and growing. And
so my friend Ty Dafik was biking over for lunch several weeks in a row, and turned out he was really into gardening, started offering his help in the yard with our very unkept garden beds, and he was doing a great job. And he met some other folks in the cafe, and they got together and started this group that meets every week and does the gardening for us as part of their meditation. And it's been beautiful. He has three other people that come almost every week with him to do that. They water, they weed, they harvest. It's amazing.
So you mentioned that you would love to talk to anybody about replicating or mm-hmm. using this model to jump off from, right? Mm-hmm. Has anybody taken the plunge?
Yeah, there is a friend up in Ashland, Wisconsin, who started a Pay What You Can cafe called Stone Soup. That idea that everybody brings something to make the soup. And they are, I think, offering meals twice a month on a Saturday. They're starting small. But he just came down for like three Saturdays in a row and said, teach me everything. What do you do? How did you do this? What was your process? Where do I get the food? How do I find volunteers? How do I form a board? I just told him everything. I shared our entire paper trail with him. And they're off and running. And then a cafe out in Pennsylvania, which is also a Moravian endeavor, called Essentials Cafe. Some Moravian clergy and lay people who wanted to start something in one of the old parsonages of a church. The pastor moved out and she said, now we can use it. So they converted the house into this adorable community cafe, and they've been up and running for several months now.
Christy Melby Gibbons is the executive director of Trickleby Cafe. She spoke with WUWM environmental reporter Susan Bentz. You'll hear more climate solution stories all week on Lake Effect and WUWM. We'll tell you about Wisconsin's Ice Age Trail next on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. This is Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Joy Powers. Summer may be winding down, but there's still plenty of opportunities to get outside in Wisconsin. One place you can check out is the Ice Age Trail. It's one of just 11 national scenic trails in the U.S., and it's all contained right here in Wisconsin. To learn a little bit about how the trail was established and what you can see on it, Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen speaks with Melissa Pierick with the Ice Age Trail Alliance.
The trail is approximately 1,200 miles. It runs from St. Croix Falls all the way down as far as Janesville, where it's the southernmost point of the trail, up to Pottawatomie State Park in Sturgeon Bay. The route of the trail roughly follows where the last glacier ended. And so the trail is full of geological significance, and it takes you through so many great areas of the state. The path is very different from the North Woods down into the southern area, which is more urban, and then up into the Door County area. It's just, there's a lot of variety on the trail.
And the trail's been around since the 1950s. Can you talk a little bit about how the trail was established?
Sure. In the 1950s, Ray Zillmer first envisioned the idea of what was to become the Ice Age Trail. He was really enamored with the topography and the geology of the Northern Kettle Moraines. And he knew a lot about the glaciation that took place in the state. At the time, though, he envisioned it as a national park, a 1,000-mile-long national park. Ultimately, the National Park Service decides, hey, they don't have an interest of having a national park that's that long. And unfortunately, Zillmer dies unexpectedly, and the efforts kind of die back for a few years until Congressman Henry Royce comes into play, and he kind of picks the idea back up of this national trail. And he really championed the idea of a trail through Wisconsin that would highlight the important glaciation that happened in our state. And so, through the course of many events and many years, the Ice Age Trail was formed in 1980.
What are some of the most popular stretches of the trail?
There are more than 100 segments of trail, and some of the most popular segments, you have the section that runs through Interstate State Park, which is beautiful, and that's where the western terminus of the trail is, and it looks out over the river, and it's gorgeous. You have the Dells of the Eau Claire, another spectacular and short segment. You have the great segments that go through Lang Lane County that are all run through county forest land. You have segments in Taylor County that run through the Shawinigan-Nicolet National Forest. Those segments really give you a North Woods feel. People will see bears sometimes in those segments. Of course, Devil's Lake State Park, the trail runs around Devil's Lake. That's always a popular place. But one of the great things about the trail is that it takes you to these places that you probably would never otherwise visit. For example, Milton. I've lived in Wisconsin my whole life, and it wasn't until I started hiking the trail that I went to Milton. And the trail runs through many, many communities, including Milton, and it's lovely. You get to check out these small towns in Wisconsin and really get a feel for Wisconsin, you have the Southern Kettle Moraines. The segments that run through the Southern Kettle Moraines are fun and hilly. The Northern Kettle Moraines, even more hilly. Oh, and then you go through the segment of Point Beach, and that's spectacular. You walk along the sand, you have the lake. I mean, it can also be miserable if you hit it when it's raining and cold. But I mean, there's just so many great places along the trail. And if you talk to hikers, everybody has a different favorite segment.
Melissa Pierick is the Director of Marketing and Community Relations at the Ice Age Trail Alliance. She spoke with Lake Effect's Becky Mortensen last spring. And you can hear more of that conversation at WUWM.com. And that wraps up today's show. Thank you so much for being here with us. I'm Joy Powers. If you missed any of today's conversations, or if you'd like to take Lake Effect on the go, download our podcast. Search for Lake Effect wherever you get your podcasts to listen to all of our shows on demand. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll explore former President Donald Trump's appeal to some Wisconsin voters. Plus, we'll learn what Milwaukee is made of in a new series that looks at the materials that make up our city. That's all tomorrow at noon, right here on Lake Effect, on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.